connections. Hazırlayan ve sunan Tim Hallam.
I'm used to both. Good evening and welcome to Connections with me, Tim Hallam. And you're very privileged tonight. Well, it's my great privilege and your great privilege to welcome Mr. NAFTA. Good evening, sir.
Hello.
Hello. It's good to see you. Come all the way from the other side of the Bosphorus.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
Ultimately from Ireland.
Yeah. Well, I see your Úscadar accent. I think that's how people can really tell.
Oh, that's it, yeah. Working class Cadgui.
It's in the breeding, isn't it? Well, we've got a bit of a musical journey, if you will.
Yeah, I picked out a bunch of things that were formative influences for me from the very first single I bought, first album, and then up to the point, I guess, where I started to become really heavily involved in DJing and music production, which was, well, I didn't really get into that properly in the production side until about 98. DJing, I started at about 94. And the DJ music direction I took was very much part of the UK rave scene, jungle scene at the time. But before that, you know, since getting into music myself as a kid, I'd first got into synth-based stuff and then evolved into anthemic rock. Then had a journey through gothic rock for a while, and then got into more, I don't know, it was just called indie, I suppose, at the time, alternative, indie. I don't really know what it was called, you know, a lot of it in English, but a good bit of American as well in the early 90s, I suppose.
I know you've told me before that you did raves where there were records with soil on them and things like that.
Yeah, that was just part of the thing. I mean, the reason for that basically was because when that all started off, there was nowhere for people to go, and there was nowhere for people to play that music, and that music wasn't accepted in clubs. I mean, in Ireland, I don't know, but at least in the UK, as far as I know, the club scene was dominated by this kind of what was it called? Even Rare Groove or something?
Rare Groove. No, shoegazing was later, wasn't it?
The thing about shoegazing and all that was that was venue, the live music, and whereas DJ music, that was the big thing. It was the difference. You know, either you were live or you weren't. I mean, this is what we were talking about just before we went on air. It's always been a political difference, at least on maybe in the last 15, 10 years, people don't care about that as much anymore. But back then, it was always a really big deal. So when the rave thing started off, it was looked down upon for a long time by the rock cognoscenti, who felt very threatened by it, you know. So
these people playing two records at once, yeah. Just not right, is it, yeah. Geezer?
Do you know who is credited as the very first person in history to do that?
What, play two records at once?
Yeah.
Oh, it's not Jimmy Savile, is it?
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
There you go. I knew it. I think he was the first rapper as well.
Oh, no. Is there anything he hasn't ruined?
It's just Todd, the damn thing for life.
It's just the opposite of the... Is there an opposite to the Midas touch? I don't know what that is.
Oh, the anti-Midas. All he touched turned to soil or something.
But whatever, anyway. If you gave the world anything positive, it was the idea of playing two records at the same time.
Who would have thought it?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to start off with something very synthy indeed from 1979, I think. Gary Newman. Yeah, this is your first single.
Yeah, myself and my brother bought it, I believe. We shared the incredible cost price of 99 pence, which is what I think singles were for a very long time.
It's a lot of money in them days.
It was, but we were forced to. We'd seen Gary Newman appear on Top of the Pops, and I think we had the same reaction that a majority of people had when they saw him, which is they were kind of blown away, and it just sounded and looked unlike anything we'd ever really heard before. So that definitely sent me on a particular musical trajectory. I mean, looking back now, a lot of the kind of the visual stuff looks pretty dated and sometimes kind of ridiculous, but there's still something about the quality of it, and that's even in there, the sound, there's something about it that seems weirdly futuristic still, I think, at least to me. So it has an enduring appeal.
He certainly does. And the just before we put him on, the face, was that talcum powder or some sort of accident with talc,
no,
I think?
No, I believe his mother used to do his makeup for him.
All right. Well, that's something, obviously where I went wrong.
Well, yeah, it's the attention to detail.
Here's Cars. You did it so good. I've just got a sort of mental picture of you and your brother sort of scrapping on that record.
Oh no, you know what's even weirder is what we used to do. I'm not sure. Actually, was it for that side? I think the B side of that single was this weird thing called Asylum. Maybe we did it with both of them. But we used to mime the songs. We used to put the songs on. Bear in mind, we were children. We used to put the songs on and then just pretend to play the whole thing from beginning to end. I don't know if we had different sections for solos or whatever the hell. We had no idea what was really going on. We knew it was synths, basically. We thought we knew we were pressing some synthy thing. But yeah, we mimed our way through those tracks many a time.
I know what I did, something similar. I was perhaps about the same age, I mean, probably going into the 1980s. I used to pretend that I had an album by the Wombles and that there were various cats playing some of the instruments, but I wasn't actually playing live.
Oh, you were directing, perhaps?
No, I was visualizing, I think.
Oh, that was okay. Thing. Well, but if you'd come around to where we were, you could have joined in.
I'm really sorry about that, yeah, because I did like Gary Numan, I've got to say. But
well, you could have played lead on all his records, much like we did.
Yeah, and how did you sort of perfect the air synth thing?
It's pretty easy if you have a table.
Yeah,
that's all you need. But the what's that? I don't know what it's called. The kind of guitar synth that hadn't come in quite yet.
Mm. Oh yeah, no, I think Maria Fassbender used to play one or something like that.
Yeah, no, we were just strictly old school.
Yeah,
keyboards.
I know my granddad had two tables. One was smaller than the other, and I used to pretend that I was wiring them up together to make a super keyboard.
That seems like a similar kind of logic.
Yeah. And yeah, somehow it had a flat surface, this keyboard, and you had to be sort of very proficient to play it.
There's something. I don't know. The idea of just imitating it. I mean, kids are pretty imitative in general, I suppose. I guess that's what it is. But it's your early musical experiences. You so want to be part of them, you know. I think that's probably where it comes from. Just this thing of, like, I want to be involved in making this great sound or this atmosphere or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, it make it look so easy as well, don't they?
Well, that's the thing about synths, because we were talking about that great documentary just before.
Synth Britannia.
I think at one point, either Gary Numan or one of the chaps from OMD, or maybe Human League, they're actually making a point. They're just saying in an interview, you don't have to learn all these chords, you know. I don't even have to learn one chord. I can, and it hurts my fingers. I can just put my finger in the keyboard and make this sound.
just like, it doesn't matter what sound. I mean, as long as there's a sound somewhere.
Well, no, in fairness, then it all becomes a case of, you know, what you don't play as much as what you do, I suppose. And that's why generally most of the great synth records are really simple, you know, because they're just paring away everything else. They're just keeping the one or two things that work really well, I suppose. So I wouldn't say it's without aesthetic choices, but nonetheless there's an amazing simplicity to it, you know.
By all means. And we're going on our musical journey now. Well, we started off with a very sort of journey sort of object, cars. That's a good thing to start on a musical journey, isn't it? And we're going to, the first junction, if you like, which is Fire by U2.
Yeah, they were the first band, really, I got into, I suppose. And this is the first single by them that really hooked me. I heard this on the radio. And at the time, and again, it's very difficult to really convey that to post-internet or non-pre-internet people.
Yeah, non-pre-internet people.
What they're called.
NPIs.
But just how in the world pre-internet, when your opportunities to hear or find new cultural things were so unbelievably limited. And if you think yours were limited in England growing up in the 70s or 80s, you should have tried Ireland at the same time. Believe me, it was really quite unbelievable. So any little shard or fragment you got of something that had colour or life or a sense of mystery or something, you would jump upon, you know, I suppose. So, yeah, you two were quite a phenomenon at the time. I mean, needless to say, I can't stand them now. You know, Bono makes me want to puke. And, you know, I think...
You're not pro-Bono, then?
God, I mean, I think a lot of people in Ireland feel the same way. They just feel terribly embarrassed, really, at best. But they were quite vital. They were a vital force originally. Not just musically, even socially. They were initially in the beginning, the early years. They seemed progressive and young, and they seemed to want something new. And that was their social stroke political side, I suppose. But I mean, even just musically, they were coming off the sort of the new wave sound. And I still have quite a bit of time for the first, I suppose, 1, 2, 3, 4 albums, maybe. Mm. I still like things up to Joshua Tree. And then they went all rattling home. They went to America. I just wasn't.
Sort of, yeah, you know, went a bit.
It just didn't wash. It didn't. They were never a rock and roll band to me. You know, they wanted to be one later on. They decided they wanted to be, but they never. They weren't that. And I think if you listen to a song like this one, like Fire, it's kind of all over the place in a lot of ways, and there's just so many changes in different sections and a very strange feeling. That's what I used to get from early YouTube, very odd, yearning kind of feeling, but it was hard to pin down. Maybe that's one of the reasons that they hadn't appealed, because there was an element of mystery to it, you know. But back then, they weren't They were very eager to prove themselves still, you know, I think. And you can really hear that sort of energy trying to explode outwards. And then they worked with some good, competent producers and stuff in the early years too. So they were able to make that kind of singular sort of new wave stripped down sound work in their favor, you know. I mean, it's only when they became much more orchestrated that I think they just got a bit flabby musically, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, as you say, this was coming out of an environment where I think, other than Thin Lizzy and things like that, you probably just have show bands.
In Ireland, yeah, the whole music scene was dominated by that, as far as I understand. I mean, that was before my time, but if you wanted to go out, you were going to see a show band, which is like just a band playing covers of other people's music, essentially, you know. So even the idea of a band coming all the time and playing all their own material was almost quite new, you know. But everyone knew there was no opportunity in Ireland, so it was always the case of, when are they going to leave? When are they going to go to England or maybe even America ultimately and try and make success of themselves there? So I don't begrudge them the success, no matter how bloated and revolting they've become now.
None of it.
But just musically, I think the very early period, there are moments of something quite special. I think this song is one of them.
It is fire.
Nearly everyone you know cooks electrically or will.
There's a message there for all of us, I think. Cook electric. Get a good deal.
Good advice.
Absolutely. I think it's pretty sage counsel, isn't it? Get off those gas rings now. And, well, that was Fire by U2 from 1981. And
Could you hear Larry Mullen's militaristic drumming that he got playing for the Artane Boys Band, which was a local kind of Catholic sort of marching band?
Really? That's where he picked up them drumming skills.
He can do all those little military style roles. Yeah.
Well, if you're going to do any sort of military jigs, then you're going to have to a sort of militarized drummer. So that was a big good bit of drumming from Larry Mullen there.
I think he started drumming when they picked him up, and he hasn't stopped since.
I often wondered in a sort of parallel universe if there is a U2, but like with Bono as like a side person, and then Larry Mullen Jr. doing like all the spangly drum solos and singing.
Maybe Upside Down World or something.
Maybe like the Ringo of U2, wasn't
yeah,
he, really?
Maybe the alternate, like little parallel universe for Larry.
Sort of seeing him doing films with Peter Sellers or something like that. I think you were saying that Adam Clayton's your favourite.
I never liked him back then because in the beginning I liked Bono because, you know, he seemed earnest and sort of hero-like, and, you know, me being a young fellow,
well, I
thought I want to be like that. But later when he became insufferable, I started my reappraisal, and then I started to think, you know, Adam Clayton, as I said, he, you know, married a supermodel, got busted for drugs, and, you know, didn't join U2's Christian club.
Yeah, I mean,
he seems to come out of the whole thing pretty well. Yeah, quite these. Plus, he's a fan of a friend of mine who's a photographer. So, and he's given him a lot of support. So
pretty good.
That's really cool. He loves his photography. You know.
Yeah. You sort of get the idea that you know, he's a nice guy to be out with on a Saturday night, sort of thing.
Yeah. He seems quite genuine. You know, and you wouldn't have to put up and listen to Bono. Oh my God.
Oh, yeah. That'd be one of those nights, wouldn't it?
Oh.
We've got Ultravox coming up.
Yeah, indeed. This is a tune from my first album then, which I got probably a couple of years later, I suppose. I'm not quite sure when. But they used to have a somewhat different incarnation, which I believe is the more credible one, when they had John Fox as their lead singer.
That's right.
Before Midgeur came in. And I think when
there was the Ultravox as well. They had the article in front, I think.
That's right, yeah. I think their sound or their instrumentation was even quite different. I'm pretty sure they're certainly more, they're regarded now as more the musically credible, the earlier one, if you like. Whereas the version that I got into was very much this one, which it was synthy, but a very melodramatic kind of feel to it as well. I mean, anyone who's seen it, this is a pretty big song, though. As you said yourself, it was with the signature drum beat at the beginning, and then, as again somebody mentioned, the Since Britannia song. How many like massive commercial singles have a switch to double time and then a viola solo in the solo in the middle? You know?
Yeah,
it is pretty. When you think about it, in those ways, it does. It is a very accessible pop song, but it's also very odd. And would a pop song like that be made today? I don't think so. You know,
tragically from getting to number one for many weeks, I think,
by a good friend of yours.
Someone we might hear a little snippet of in a little while.
Yeah, it's weird when you mentioned that to me before the show, because I actually do have an inkling of a traumatic memory from that time. Because at the time when I was into music, myself and my brother were into it, we were extremely tribal about it, and we'd religiously watch Top of the Pops every week. Willing whoever was our hero, usually just Gary Numan, to be number one instead of the Police or whoever his enemies were at the time.
Did you share Ultravox with your brother?
No. Ultravox was my thing.
Ultravox,
that was my thing by that stage. I'm not sure what he'd gone on to by that point, but famously, I still remember Ultravox being held off the number one spot in the UK by, as I said, a good personal friend of yours.
Hi.
What's his name?
Joe Giuseppe Dolci.
Yeah. Who I believe never made a return appearance. I think that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's in the Guinness Book of One-Hit Wonders.
One-Hit Wonder.
He certainly is. Well, there was an album. There was an album called Shut Up Your Face.
All right, named after the eponymously titled.
I'm surprised that you didn't go out with your brother and get that one as well, because that was one of the happening sounds of the time, evidently.
I mean, I guess it is part of the charming history of Top of the Pops is that no matter what was happening musically, at any point, an insane novelty record could just take over the whole world for a while, and that was it. And it seemed like it was a logic nobody could deny. So however earnest and fantastic and futuristic and melancholic Ultravox were, they just couldn't match the power of...
Well, what you've got to remember is just when Vienna was in the charts, I think it was February 1981, if I'm going to be specific, it was around that time. And this was, of course, just after the untimely death of John Lennon in December 1980. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would have been nice if there was a sort of Christmas number one and John Lennon's, you know, posthumous single was in the charts.
True.
And it was St. Winifred's Girls Choir, Pipped Them to the Post. That was that is another sort of, you know, that was a kind of 12 months of travesty, that really.
Yeah.
So, it's...
let's restore Ultravox to their proper position.
Well, here they are, Ultravox. And, good night, Vienna.
Thank you.
the radio station, episode CPA 5938. In this week's episode, we're going to look at Line of Best Fit, that programme that's brought from that cornerstone of culture, Vaughan Fitzrichardson, every Thursday night at 9 p.m. The concept of the show is that each week he looks at somebody's musical journey from an origin to a destination, and then tries to draw a line of best fit. It's as simple as that. I might add that the lucky participant every week gets to choose the mode of transport for their musical journey, and also the location. Hello, and welcome to Line of Best Fit. This is Vaughan Richardson, cornerstone of culture, and I'm with Darren Axis. Darren, first things first, what have you chosen as your mode of transport for today?
Oh yeah, it's a 1974 Plaxton Elite 45-seater.
And can you tell the listeners where we're driving around, please?
Grimsby.
Any particular reason?
It's real.
Can you just, for the benefit of the listeners at home, describe what you're seeing outside the window?
Well, it's raining. There's some bollards, actually. There's quite good bollards in Grimsby. People don't really realise this, but they've been used as keep left signs for quite a while, but do like a good bollard.
So, Darren Axis.
Yeah, that's my name.
Axis is quite a strange name, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I was born Darren Access, and, I pestered my dad because I liked the Jimi Hendrix Experience album, Axis, Bold of Love. I liked the title. I thought Jimi Hendrix was a bit of a racket, but did like the title, so I became Darren Access in 1969, legally.
And where did your musical journey begin? What bus station did you get on at?
Well, I was born in 1960... And my grandma bought me in 1967 a 1962 copy of Toshi Ichinagi's Activities. Totally blew my mind.
It's quite an unusual choice for a 7-year-old, isn't it?
I don't know, really. She used to put it on when she used to bring fish and chips home, and it just reminds me of eating chips, really.
And moving on from there.
Well, you know, I was turning 8 in 1968, as you've probably worked out, and I started getting quite a fascination for nettles. And in order to sort of fully understand nettles, I heard a piece by David Tudor called Rainforest, and totally flipped me round. And, you know, there wasn't really a day when I, you know, stopped playing Toshi Ichinagi, but, you know, I did noticeably... can't get my words out today, play them less.
And after that, any different sort of paradigmic shifts?
No, I've got to say I played David Tudor to death. Until that was about 1973, started getting into interested in girls and that sort of thing. And I just heard Gilbert O'Sullivan's Get Down, and that was it. That was totally it. Never played David Tudor after that, or Toshi Ichinagi. I did play him once, I think, on a day in 1976, but it was by accident.
What was the extent of your love of Gilbert O'Sullivan?
Well, as I say, I bought all his Mam albums, just went and got his back catalogue himself, back to front. I'm a writer, not a fighter. I got an 8-track of I'm a writer, not a fighter as well, just a bit of a collectible. Stranger in My Own Backyard, Southpaw, that was brilliant, that one. And then I was a little bit put out in 1980 when he moved to the CBS label and he bought out Off Centre. And to add to that, I got a little bit of sort of mild warping on my copy of I'm a Writer, Not a Fighter. So I went into a shop and I heard, about 1981, I just heard it was this guy called Joe Dolce, and that were it. My mind was blown. I were gone. There was no turning back after that. And after that, as I say, Joe Dolce, that were it. I mean, occasionally I put the other side on, Septembre, but that's it. And anything else? Got Jive Bunny in 1989. Oh, I did pick up John Cage. It were in a second-hand shop at about 1990. It was a recording. I think it was from an original 78 of Daughters of the Lonesome Isle. I thought, yeah.
Yeah, that was from maybe their first EP. I think it was about 1990, something like that.
Still have EPs in those days.
They did, yeah. They famously, I mean, you know, at their level, but they put out a three, I think, EPs before the first album. And the EPs generated a big buzz with the local or the weekly music papers. I used to read Melody Maker at the time, so I guess that's probably where I heard about them first. But I saw them playing in at my university in the, you know, the kind of in the bar, doing a bar gig when they were still unknown. I suppose virtually, you know, apart from people like me who read Enemy or whatever it happened to be. And they were fantastic, and they were incredibly loud and incredibly noisy. You know, this even that record sounds a little restrained by comparison to how they were when they were loud. I guess they were not quite contemporaries, following immediately in the footsteps of My Bloody Valentine, who I didn't know at the time, and who were based in Dublin, I believe, at that point, and doing something really quite new with guitars. And then I suppose the scene that ride came to dominate for a few years, which was called, what was the name of the scene?
Not shoegazing.
Shoegazing was kind of came after, but it was associated with them. Yeah, it was this sort of drenched in feedback. But then there was a slight looking back as well. There was using like wah-wahs and using old style guitar sounds and pedals and vintage equipment and stuff that hadn't been used before. It wasn't really self-consciously aping the 70s in the same way, or in the way that you got more with bands like Spaceman 3 and Loop later on.
Do you think that was industry-driven, or do you think that actually came out of
that? No, it wasn't. It definitely wasn't. I mean, the industry had just hadn't cottoned on to that at that point, and it was still, bands like Ride had to, they made all their early successes or you know, on indie labels at the time, because major labels didn't get it. So I think maybe their first album came out in the major. I'm not sure about that. Or was it Creation, perhaps? Which would have been...
Yeah.
Like a, almost like a major for the indies, I suppose, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Indie music was, at least in England, I think, seemed to be blissfully free. I mean, it was just a whole different paradigm. It was weird, you know, because bands couldn't get their stuff out unless they got access to their equipment and the recording space, and the distribution was totally controlled by record companies and all that. So then there was this lower tier of indie small labels that would give minor bands with different sounds or more challenging ideas an opportunity to do that too. But it was just such a different universe. It's hard to imagine now in a weird way. Now, if you just, you know, you want to make music, you just make it, you put it out on the internet, and you don't make any money.
Easier said than done, isn't it? But
well, yes and no. I mean, things, you can do the whole thing at home now. You know, I do. I know. I'm not making a band sound, but I've been making music at home for years, just on a computer. And ultimately, if I make something that's, I can just put it out. And, you know, the next day I can have 20 million hits on YouTube, and YouTube make a lot of money, and I don't make anything.
It's great. That's the way it goes. It's the industry. Yeah. It was
the industry always wins. That's one thing you need to understand, is if you're in any way creatively inclined, unless you are one in a million, lightning striking lucky. Otherwise, forget about it. You're going to be making it for the love of it and losing money your whole life. But that's just how it is. So that never changes. It doesn't matter. Everything else can change, but that doesn't change.
All good. Well, we've got a bit of Jane's Addiction coming up now.
Yeah, Jane's Addiction were my brother had got into not as early as the 70s, but he later on got into things like Iron Maiden, and he got into what's now called the new wave of British heavy metal, I suppose, and all that stuff. A few years later,
Whitesnake and things like that.
he dabbled with that, but that was more, yeah, actually, to be frank, that was more the area. My sister was more into that. She was more into Def Leppard and that kind of thing. He got into some of the extreme stuff just because he's that kind of person, I suppose. He tends to be drawn to extremes. So ultimately, he got into stuff like Slayer and Napalm Death and all that, you know, somewhere down the line. So I was never a metalhead, but I used to feed off that and hear certain bands I liked and stuff that was a little in there, but a little bit different, always had a real appeal to me. Something like Suicidal Tendencies initially, because they were this kind of ethnic mix, you know, in LA. They had this Hispanic, Mexican, Latin feel to them as well, a mixture of punk and a mixture of metal. And I think of Jane's Addiction somewhere in the same category, not exactly the same musically at all. They were more their own thing, but metal for them was a kind of a vernacular at the time that they adopted to a certain extent, but they were never constrained by it. And they just did the first two albums. This is a short piece in the first album. Then the second album, I think,
is particularly tremendously good, and it's really quite unique. And they were doing all things that are very unmetal, but they were able to kind of harness this energy and power and scale and drama of metal at the same time.
Unmetal, but metal.
Well, yeah, but not that they were against it or something. I don't know if they even had any viewpoint in it that way, but it's just that metal is like any genre that's very much a thing unto itself. Or like techno, the best of it is absolutely amazing, and it's incredibly singular and concentrated, but then there's masses of just turgid, awful, you know, carbon copy things all are surrounding it. I suppose you could say that about a lot of genres, but it seems particularly apparent for things that are so focused, like techno or like metal. So it's very easy to sort of lose sight of what works really well about it, just from a listener's point of view. If you kind of lose track, I suppose, or of the best that's out there, the best it has to offer. And for me, Jane's Addiction were really, really unique, really, really different, but they have a very, they're musically really interesting, but they have a very kind of, I don't know, there's almost a spiritual quality or something to them as well.
Yeah, there's a lovely dropout in this about 30 seconds in.
Yeah, they're just, I don't know, maybe a lot of people missed out on them, and in the later years they reformed all that. I don't really care about all that kind of thing.
It's the
just,
new Jane's Addiction.
Yeah, it's whatever. I mean, I don't begrudge people like that, because a lot of them made no money the first time around, so I don't really mind if they make some money for the retirement, but I don't really care about the later incarnations, you know.
Two groups of Addiction and Jane's Ad.
But the first two albums particularly, are just stellar as far as I'm concerned, and they just sound really fresh today.
Let's go up the beach.
It would be nice to go up the beach, wouldn't it? There we are.
Jane's Addiction, who were unfortunately a little bit too addicted at the beginning there. Don't quite know what happened. One of those things. Promises made about CD stories that weren't kept and all that sort of thing. We're moving to the Stone Roses now.
Yeah, Stone Roses were, I think they did had a similar impact upon me as upon a lot of other people. Actually, by that stage, I would say I was already starting to get interested in more non-rock stuff, you know, talking about right at the end of the 80s and early 90s. But Stone Roses are one of those bands, probably the band really of the time, or the first one, well, next to Happy Mondays, when you talk about UK bands, who didn't see a contradiction between liking, you know, the Beatles or guitar stuff or the Birds or any of that, the classic sort of 60s, 70s rock-oriented music, and DJ rave music, you know, house music that was coming from Chicago and, you know, via Ibiza coming into the UK and kicking off the rave scene. And they didn't see a contradiction between those two things. For them, it was just all music they loved.
Woefully mismanaged as well.
Yeah, I mean, because I kind of followed the thing at the time. As I said, I used to read Melody Maker and I used to follow it in the press, and it was just like the ultimate example of the industry just screwing itself and screwing people, and you know, it's just a horrible mess that meant that they are a classic band who, to this day, I think most people, even their biggest fans, will say never realized their potential, you know, because the famous second album that took forever and was then pretty weak by comparison, I think. But I think the first album had kind of been cobbled together. I'm not sure they actually wrote the whole thing. I think
it wasn't as sort of coherent as you might think it was. I think it was like
but in a way, maybe there was never a way to make the Stone Roses coherent either. And, you know, I say that as someone who has seen them live after their peak, arguably. I think I saw them about like 95. And my God, that dude could not sing. I'll tell you that much.
Well, the whole band.
I mean, they were as like them, maybe not as extreme as Happy Mondays, according to the legendary tales. But they were just working class lads who just took every opportunity that came their way, and inevitably just weren't prepared for, you know, what happened. And I think a lot of them got really messed up by it, or they were living in an environment where a lot of people did. So that's a shame, you know. But regardless, even if they had been better managed, I'm not sure they would have made a perfect coherent album either. They were a kind of a messy phenomenon, you know, much like the Mondays. Mondays are probably even messier.
Oh, yeah.
And so maybe there was no way to put all that onto a record, you know. And even the nature of their events, I think when they were initially really creating a hype, it was more like a party than a concert to a certain extent. There was a participatory part to it, which reflected the change in how people were moving into rave, and the dance floor was becoming the center of attention.
Spike Island was the famous one, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So
again, woefully mismanaged. Mr. Evans.
But the track that I picked here was obviously one of their best known, "Fool's Gold." But I mean, that was a really important track for me because it has the signature element of the music that I would then get into for the next more than 10 years, which was, you know, rave music, hardcore breakbeat music, jungle as it became known, or drum and bass, which was based around the idea of taking a loop, a drum loop, usually from a 60s or 70s funk record, and looping it as the sort of backbeat, and it gave it this polyrhythmic feel, which is different from the standard kind of on the beat, fourth the floor, that dominated.
A lot to thank Jimmy Savile for at the end of the day, haven't we?
Well, James Brown gets a bit of thanks here as well, though, in fairness. But the unholy combination of Jimmy Savile and James Brown, you could say, sent me on this particular journey.
Well, there is.
But if you listen to it, basically what you hear underneath Fool's Gold is it kind of became my religion for the next 10 years.
Let's not lose any more religion. And just before, I've got Gareth Evans himself talking about what would happen if the Stone Roses ever, at that point, did get back together. And this is the voice of an ex-underpants salesman, I think.
If the Stone Roses reformed, I'd jump at the chance to manage them. They can only be great with me. I am one of the Stone Roses. I am the Stone Roses.
That was beautiful. That was Fool's Gold from, what was it, 1990, end of 1990, 91?
I think it might have been even 88, 89, yeah, I'm not sure, around then, certainly. I think it had been on the go for a while before it got recorded, but
yeah.
But who knows with them?
God, was that kind of the middle track? It was until the second album, I think. After that, wasn't it? That was.
And then they had that One Love thing or something, which is a bit of a letdown, I think.
Yeah, remember?
And not One Love. What was it called? Something I can't remember.
Oh, there were some tracks they did in 1987 or something like that. Yeah. Anyway, Shane, it's Mr. Nefta. Let your secret slip there.
I'm fine with either.
The end of the show.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
I mean, we had lots and lots of tracks lined up, but I think the sort of insight into those tracks has been far more interesting than just listening to a load of tracks one on one. So I think
Well, I like them all, so I'll talk about any of them.
All right. Well, there's lots of scope for a few more damn good shows, so
happy to come back and bore you with more of my
pleasure
selection.
And a privilege, sir. Both pleasure and a privilege. So is there anyone you want to say hello to before we go?
I want to give a shout out to Ireland, which has repealed the 8th Amendment yesterday, which was a big ongoing issue in Ireland about women's reproductive rights and our draconian laws that really had put them in a very bad position for a very, very long time, and we were told forever it couldn't be changed, and the people have voted to change it. So I know everybody I know in Ireland has been really behind that a lot, big time, recently. Brilliant. And they've put a huge amount of effort into it, so congratulations to them if anybody there is listening.
Yes. Anybody else?
And all my Istanbul compadres.
Oh, they're all out there somewhere.
Yeah. I better give a special shout out to Ross Bunnell, who's languishing in Wirral right now.
He is. Yeah. Well, he was in that chair that you're in about two weeks ago this very night.
Yeah. Well, it's an honour. Honour to share the same chair.
Share the chair.
Good luck to you, sir. Yes. Wherever you are.
You sounded like him then as well.
I do.
Good Ross impersonation. Anyway, as I say, it's been a pleasure and a privilege. I've got Simon literally kicking and screaming he's not screaming the door down, but he's probably going to kick the door down in a minute. So we better get drag kicking and screaming off air. And, as I say, thanks very, very much. I've thoroughly enjoyed our romp through not that many songs, in fact, but,
Plenty more where they came from.
Plenty more. Looking forward to it, sir.
Next time.
Until next time, keep down. Keep down, keep low, keep safe, keep warm, and keep connected. Good night.
Connections. Was erlernt, Tim Hallam.